I'm Bill Buebert, retired Army officer and irregular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts, an irregular warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency, and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together.
This is Bill, and welcome to episode 48 of Chasing Ghosts, an Irregular Warfare podcast. Today's episode is entitled CG Excursion, Peer Strike, ISR Complex, The Need for Rational Fires Coordination. Now, this is going to be a rather technical discussion, but before we get to that, we're going to do a little bit of housekeeping. Just came from the symposium that I attend on an annual basis, at which it's a professional association of which I'm a member. I'm a working group chair, and I give a number of talks and presentations there to include tutorials on topics like anti-fragility in future conflict and anti-fragility in systems engineering. This year I gave two talks, among others. The first one was a derivation of the Nagorno-Karabakh podcast that I gave last time, a fortnight ago. And this is another one here, the Peer Strike ISR Complex, where I talked about the Russian strike reconnaissance complex that started to emerge from the 21st century renaissance that the Russian army was experiencing after getting over their 11-year hangover of taking the USSR and hanging it on a shelf and getting in the new skin suit of the Russia that we know today and revamping, reorienting, and reassessing the tactics, techniques, procedures, the tactical, operational, strategic, and even grand strategic synchronization that they've had to achieve to pretty much say what I see in the Russian army, and I'm seeing it in other peer and near-peer armies planet-wide, is that the 21st century has inaugurated a new way of doing war, a revolution in military affairs. That includes the things that I've talked about in the past. If you're a new listener, I would urge you to go back and listen to some of those podcasts. For instance, when I talk about salvo competition in a previous episode, and I talk about the last episode with Nagorno-Karabakh, I talk about the importance of robotics. And what we're finding here is that there is a rippling, a Venn diagram, as it were, of these kind of things coalescing together to be something that is greater than the sum of its parts in the final manifestations on what this looks like in the battle space and on the battlefield. You will find a variety of book recommendations and PDF recommendations to get a further deep dive into some of the things that I'm going to cover today and I have covered in the past. And I wanted to urge my listeners to continue to recommend this podcast, if you like it, to others, to join in this conversation that we're having over the previous 2 years and the next few years until I assume room temperature, and continuing to delve into these topics. You can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I would love for you to visit my Substack, where I have a comment function for every one of my episodes. Any comments or recommendations you have in a gentlemanly fashion that recommend maybe new topics I should cover, maybe expansions or expanded illustrations on what I'm trying to discuss and get the conversation going on here about. While I don't cover too many contemporaneous topics, it just so happens that within the last fortnight, there was an attempted assassination on a presidential candidate, if not a presidential figure. In this case, it would be Donald Trump, and the Secret Service just failed this examination, the first one they've had since 1981, in a spectacular fashion. And it's been a chaos avalanche and a cavalcade of calamities within the Secret Service and their organizational synchronization with local police forces and things like that. It's been the hotbed for creating new conspiracy theories and things like that. But I always refer to Hanlon's razor, where don't assign malice to something that can be explained or defined by incompetence. I'm paraphrasing. So we noticed that in conflicts, getting into our episode here on peer strike, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance complex, the needs for rational fires coordination, in which I will be showcasing the Russian way of war since the turn of the 21st century, riffing off of some of the other things that are happening planet-wide and various oil spots of conflict that are burbling and brewing to the top. And as I discussed in the Wayback Machine on this podcast, what you discover is that once you have larger conflicts, they start to brighten the embers of simmering more localized and regional conflicts within regional conflict complexes that cause all of these unintended consequences to start issuing forth from this and going in directions that nobody anticipated. For the most part, nobody anticipated it because they didn't do the intellectual heavy lifting to war game what in the military one would call branches and sequels, which would be what is going to emerge possibly from engaging in these conflict scenarios. Are there any kind of unintended consequences, second and third order effects, or reverberations from this that are going to affect things that we didn't quite extrapolate they could touch? So as with all of these complex layered discussions like the one we're going to talk about for rational fires coordination, which is simply taking sensors and effectors on the battlefield, in the battle space, at the tactical and operational, and on occasion, strategic level, and what happens when in a real fight between two or more near-peer or peer competitors equipped with very sophisticated platforms, what's that going to look like? Well, if we time-traveled back to the 1990s, we would assume that we didn't know what the internet would do, we didn't know what interconnectivity would do, we didn't know what satellite constellations would do, we didn't know all of these capabilities that start to coalesce around what's going to happen when these conflicts start to emerge and large armies in near-peer and peer competition and actual conflict get together. Remember, one of my adages is that it is the least incompetent force that wins battles and wins wars, because there's always going to be that degree of baked-in Clausewitzian fog and friction that will cause things to go awry that you thought you had set in place in a very sophisticated fashion that just tend to go wrong because artillery is not the king of battle. Murphy is. Murphy's law is the king of battle, and it dictates everything that happens in a battle. A little bit about definitional constructs. When I'm using the term artillery in this discussion, I am using it in the 21st century permutation. Artillery, for those who were either not in the military or maybe didn't serve in field artillery, which I did not, or aren't familiar with how artillery works, the 18th, 19th, and 20th century manifestations of artillery were usually gun tubes, and on occasion, as in World War II, the Katyusha missiles that the Russians employed, other missile modalities that were employed between 1943 and 1945, and then expanded for the remainder of the last half of the 20th century. In this case, I'm going to use a 21st century variant on the term artillery. So when you hear me talk about the West, U.S. in particular, being air-centric and aircraft-centric, the Russians have always and continue to be artillery-centric, but their artillery-centric enterprise, and I'm paraphrasing Joseph Stalin or maybe one of his field marshals in the event of World War II, that quantity has a quality all of its own. Maybe that's assigned to somebody else, but nonetheless, for the sake of this discussion, massed artillery fires were a tremendous force multiplier for the Russians towards the conclusion of World War II and their astonishing military transformation of their forces wholesale from 1943 to 1945, which led to the Germans taking four-fifths of their order of battle the entirety of the war until their surrender to the West and to the Russians in April 1945 were dedicated to stopping the Russian red tide that was starting to wash over their entire country from January to April 1945. Now, this is not to say that this 21st century implementation of artillery on the part of the Russians is a new variant. What it is, it's a riff. It's a continuation and an expansion of that definitional construct to include everything that is fired to the ground to intercept anything that is there. Well, it could go to space as far as the Chinese are concerned. But in this case, we're going to confine ourselves to air-breathing modalities. Anything that goes aloft to either end up on the ground and kill things on the ground, or anything that goes aloft and intercepts things that are coming in, whether they're unmanned or manned modalities. It could be anti-aircraft, it could be anti-unmanned aircraft. Whatever the case may be, the Russians are not only chasing that with technological developments that the West simply can't keep up with, but they are chasing it with a mass that the West simply can't keep up with. Let me quote Napoleon, one of the great captains of military history. Quote, "In a battle, as in a siege, the art consists in concentrating very heavy fire on a particular point. The line of battle once established, the one who has the ability to concentrate an unlooked-for mass of artillery suddenly and unexpectedly on one of these points is sure to carry the day." End of quote. Now, there's a lot to be said for that. Of course, one can say to a certain extent that in the far distant past, Napoleon is the father of the modern artillerist, the father of the concepts of using artillery, which is referred to as the king of battle in the West, where the infantry is the queen of battle. It is the functionality, the modality, and the weapon systems that carry the day and remove forces from places that you don't wish them to be. I'm going to reveal something to you that you can find if you do your own research, that the defense establishment in the U.S. and the West is not comfortable with disclosing. And I'm not saying they're hiding this. I'm not saying that they're secretive about it. What I'm telling you is that at the operational and strategic level, and a little bit at the tactical level, the U.S. and the West in particular, and the NATO midgets in even more particular, have no way to take sensors and effectors, sensors in this case being radar sets from the smallest to the largest, whether they are fixed or mobile or shipboard, and effectors, which is a term used in Pentagon speak, for guns and weapons and anything that sends either kinetically or non-kinetically some kind of modality forward to neutralize, destroy, or catastrophically engage other forces or other assets of forces or logistical targets or anything at all with targeting. I remember in the 1990s, Navy had this notion of distributed lethality. You can look up that curious phrase, and of course the Pentagon lives by these phrases. If the Pentagon could win wars through PowerPoint, we would own the planet as we speak, but of course we know that's impossible. Nonetheless, what did distributed lethality talk about? It talked about where you would have all of these ships, whether through their VLSs, their vertical launch systems, and the exquisite missiles that would go in there, and then various gun platforms and things like that. Even though gun platforms, even the faded 5-inch guns that won World War II in the naval victories over the Pacific, what you discover, and the Atlantic, what you discover is that we don't have a gun-centric Navy at all. We have a missile-centric Navy. The things that we do have that, for the most part, deliver munitions at a distance are going to be your phalanxes. They're those R2-D2 configurations that you see on the ship's decks that put up a wall of lead to incoming kinetic munitions to protect the ship from being catastrophically struck or sunk. The aircraft carriers presently in the fleet, 11 of them, none of them have 5-inch weapons or anything like that. There are phalanxes on board, but they don't have that kind of projectile capability. As a matter of fact, one could say that when it comes to IAMD, which is Integrated Air and Missile Defense, when it comes to Bofors-style, kinetically center fire round, these are large rounds. Like those of you who are gun owners, maybe you've got deer rifles that fire a .30-06 or a .308 or something like that. In this case, if one were to look at a 50 caliber round, which was used in quad mounts or dual mounts on board ships and such in the old days, in this case, what you'd have is 20 millimeter, 30 millimeter, 40 millimeter rounds that could be sent aloft via guns, the Beaufort style and others. And also, these are some of these were landborne until they were decommissioned. And you would send up these walls of lead to intercept things. One of the, and I need to cover this in a future episode, because when I look at drone swarms, and those could be drone swarms that are either synchronized or not synchronized, and the distinction between those two is that a synchronized drone swarm will look like a flock of birds that is coordinating their movements on a tail and a head in which they're almost flowing when you look. There's a certain aesthetic ease with which they go. Now, the unsynchronized swarm would be a swarm that's going in a general direction, but it looks a bit chaotic. It looks as if it's not smooth. It's not going in a fashion in which they're following each other. But they're going to meet a point, and at terminus, they're going to disperse to whatever their targets may be for that terminal velocity to go into whatever they're set to neutralize or destroy. I think that when you look at the picket ships off of Okinawa, Japan in April 1945, and the sheer concentration of kamikaze aircraft that was lobbed against ships, in this case, there was a vast picket line of smaller ships in the U.S. Navy. Remember, the U.S. Navy had approximately 7,500 ships by the end of the Pacific conflict, whereas now they can barely sustain 300, both surface and subsurface. Now, in this case, to me, when I look at it historically, I think this is probably, in a near-peer or peer fight, the closest modeling that we can probably come to of what actually happened in history. That's sort of like, and this is adjacent to how drone swarms work in the 21st century, what does it look like? Because kamikaze aircraft are large aircraft compared to the smaller drones, depending on the group that you're looking at. There's group 1 through 4, and I think, without looking it up, group 4 is probably weighing 1,000 pounds or more. So that's a very large aircraft, an unmanned aircraft. When you look at kamikazes, here's the really interesting thing about that, that made them very hard to take down, is they are terminally maneuverable, which means that if I were to, I'm in the Roman legions, and I take my pilum or javelin, which was carried by the legionary soldiers, it's a wooden shaft with an iron head, had a total length of about 2 meters. I had two of them in the Roman legions up until 400 A.D., and when I loft that, I have no terminal control of what's going to happen ballistically at the end, because I don't have fin surface, I don't have fin tasking, I don't have any way to maneuver it in the terminus. Kamikaze aircraft had a way to maneuver in terminus. UAS aircraft now, and I think that's going to happen more and more, even as small as they get, they will be able to terminally maneuver. And when it comes to targeting, when it comes to sensing, there is a targeting methodology, which means that I am queuing for something coming in. I discover something in a 90-degree sector. I zero in on that to define to within a few degrees how it's coming in. I have detected it. With that detection, I have some obligations to determine, well, what's the nature of it? Is it neutral? Is it hostile? Is it friendly? Is it an airliner? Is it something that I can shoot or won't shoot? By the way, for those of you who don't know, when it comes to the environments in which one in an IAMD system, an integrated air missile defense system, where you do have incoming air, and in this case, we're probably going to have incoming manned aircraft that will be lofting their unmanned missile or bomb modalities, I'm going to be in three situations. I'm going to be in weapons hold, which is I can't fire. I'm going to be in weapons tight, which is where I will need a positive identification or a lower evidentiary scale, which is going to be combat identification. Or I'm going to be in weapons free, which means that if it flies, it dies. Now, when it comes to these kind of things, I have to have the system in place. The synchronization of art from tactics to operational level to strategic level in which there's a almost seamless near real-time or real-time situational awareness and, by extension, a situational understanding, which is where the true ability of a force to prevail comes in. Because you can be aware of what's going on, but if you don't have the situational situational understanding, which means that not only are you aware, but you know why it's being done, and you know where it's headed, that's where the declaration comes in, and with that declaration comes an assignment of what weapon system you have that is harnessed and married between sensors and effectors to service that incoming target or set of targets. What the Pentagon, what the U.S., what the NATO Midgets Armed Forces are probably a little embarrassed to make headlines in whatever their tabloid of choice is that there is no rational fires coordination or synchronization effort within the respective services, much less jointly in this case, meaning services working together, that would allow us to do the things that we're presently seeing the Russians do because they've broken the code on this. And one of the reasons is they had a rational goal as a regional hegemon to service targets in under 1 minute, under 30 seconds, and eventually to have a synchronized, layered, and defense in depth and offense in depth, which would permit them to take all of these assets that they have rationally laid out on the field, synchronize those assets, have the proper command and control, and being able to service targets in the fashion that I just described, where you have the queuing, the detection, the declaration, and the assignment to whatever the targeting modality is to take it down before it hits your forces or whatever you are assigned to protect. So before I continue, I need to bring up a few definitional constructs. I realize that this is something of a fire hose where I'm trying to give you not only a tutorial, a primer on targeting methodologies, synchronization of targeting methodologies, how artillery works in the 21st century, what it's going to look like in the near-peer and peer fights ahead, because those fights are inevitable. These are fights, especially when I look at the jingoistic behavior of politicians in the West who seem so eager to get into these near-peer and peer conflicts in which diplomacy and simply an acknowledgement of China, Russia, and others having the right to be regional hegemons, but global hegemons, the sole global hegemon in this case, is going to be the United States. And think about this definitionally and heuristically. If one is the global hegemon on planet Earth, you are always putting your finger on leaks and dikes that are emerging by the minute, by the hour, by the day, by the week, forever. As a matter of fact, this is why it turns into forever wars. As I mentioned earlier about all of those embers that become forest fires, when you have a near-peer or peer fight that unleashes the civil unrest and the civil wars and the regional war complexes that were just simmering and not going so far as lighting into these full-on wars and conflicts. But the West seems to have a habit of not only stoking these, but seeing them blaze into full conflagrations in which they engage their armed forces. And then you find that victory is not only avoided, but almost impossible. One of the conceits of my podcast is that the West is absolutely incapable of conducting successful counterinsurgencies, which I will not burden you with for the reasons why. You could refer to my podcast library to find like episode 4, 2, and 4, where I discuss that very thing. And I talk about the importance of anti-fragility, insufficient logistics, insufficient planning, and all the rest that comes with the almost perfect track record of the U.S. and by extension the West not having a military victory since 1945. I would suggest that in the remainder of the 21st century, especially with, as I mentioned, the jingoistic behavior of American and NATO politicians and the warlike behavior of the U.S. for so long. And I'll tackle that in another episode in which I talk about why, since 1871, in the aborted American invasion of Korea, which failed and then went on to the 1890s, in which the annexation of Hawaii and then the annexation through war of the decrepit, arthritic, and decaying Spanish colonial empire and holdings in the Pacific and in the Caribbean and other areas was taken by force from them. And then the Americans took over that particular colony. And then, of course, what we see is we see what happened in the Philippines at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And we start to see the flavor and catastrophic moral hazard that is America's attempts at exporting its genocidal advances against aboriginals on the North American continent against aboriginals and indigs on the islands of the Philippines. And of course, yep, I'll have to handle that in a future episode. But look, war is about angles. War is about engaging forces, finding weaknesses, employing surprise, and a variety of other means to establish victory over the enemy. In order for that victory to occur, a lot of planning, a lot of logistical heft, especially if you are an expeditionary force, as is the U.S. and the West, that tends not to respond to invasions of their particular homelands, but tends to commoditize military forces logistically in expeditionary fashions to send them planet-wide to put down whatever war of choice it is that they happen to be engaged in at that time here in the 21st century. As I have bored you with on previous podcasts, we've been in Afghanistan. The West has been in Iraq. It has been in Syria. It has been in the Horn of Africa. It has been in Lebanon. It has been in Libya. It is now in Yemen, where laughably the unsynchronized when it comes to targeting and lethality. U.S. Navy recently said, and please fire everybody in your PR department, and the Naval Institute needs to start reading what they put out. Naval Institute is a private Navy booster organization that provides something of a think tank. I mean, an advocacy tank. There's no such thing as think tanks, only advocacy tanks, where they said that in the Red Sea, where the Enterprise was recently, it's going to be very interesting to see what the Enterprise looks like when it comes back to port, that they had been in some of the most intense combat since the end of World War II, which would be August 1945. And remember, this was as a result of fire from the Houthis, who don't have any navy to speak of, and what navy they do have doesn't even match the size of a corvette or a frigate. They have old patrol boats and patrol boat pluses purchased from the old Soviet Union, in which there is no hull in their navy, H-U-L-L, that has a later birthing date than 1973, but the U.S. Navy, this very expensive Navy, filled with exquisite platforms, was defeated by the Houthis. What the hell is an exquisite platform? An exquisite platform is expensive, it's manned, it has a big logistical tail, and it goes by the name of Carrier, F-35, M1 Abrams. I'm trying to cover all the forces here. Maybe it's an LPD, which would be the ships that the Marines use to embark, and then, of course, all of the vertical envelopment modalities they use, you and I as civilians would call them helicopters, in order to reach the beach. Now, why is the Marine Corps reaching the beach in amphibious operations? And amphibious operations, I put that in air quotes, because we haven't had a successful amphibian operation on a contested beach since 1951. Is this idea that you need surface maritime connectors? Well, they don't have them. That's why they use helicopters. This is the same Marine Corps that has, in my mind, wisely got rid of their manned tank corps. I am 100% behind that for a variety of reasons, and I have covered that elsewhere. But I want to introduce you to a spectrum of military intellectual parlance, which is you have exquisite platforms, like I just talked about, and then you have attritable platforms, which are sort of like maybe a marriage between exquisite minus and something that doesn't cost quite as much. Maybe it comes in greater numbers. And then you have attritable. And then you have, under attritable, what has become fashionably known as affordable mass. Now, affordable mass simply means, for the most part, and we're going to keep our distinction here very simple, what it means is those things that we can use in war that we use to service another target, usually leading to the destruction of both the target and the modality used. In this case, it could be a $6 million standard missile, or it could be a $300,000 affordable mass drone. By the way, it is $300,000 that the Pentagon is calling the floor price of the cheapest thing that they can get as far as putting together affordable mass. Now, what you have in Russia since the SMOD, the special military operation that they've been engaged in for over 2 years, is that they have something called the Lancet. I urge all of you to take a look at this, look it up, see what you think. Three generations of the Lancet, Lancet 1, 2, and 3. Looks like a four-bladed cross perpendicular on a fuselage driven by a prop. About $50,000 a piece, but they have been using these to service infantry fighting vehicles and even tanks that have been donated to the Ukrainians, like the British Challenger. There's been some French tanks that have gone over there. There's even been Abrams, even though they're withdrawing them as we speak, because what they've discovered is that take two Lancet 3s at $50,000 a piece and use those in the salvo competition to catastrophically eliminate an $8 to $10 million tank, guess who's going to win in the end in that particular competition? Now, in order to use drones, in order to use missiles, whether those missiles are borne by UAVs, whether those missiles are borne by manned aircraft, whether they are borne by tracked assets, dedicated SHORAD, short-range air defense assets, maybe they could be Quad 50s or Quad Jus, or which ZHU, which is a 12.7 millimeter variant that is common in the Russian arsenal for taking down aircraft or being used for ground targets. As a matter of fact, the Afghans would use these on occasion in some of the more infamous outpost fights in Afghanistan in which they would prevail against American arms. So you have this whole array of effectors. And in this case, the Russians have those properly synchronized in near real time and real time to put steel on target as soon as targets are identified by troops in contact, whether deliberately or hastily. The distinction there is that deliberately means that it was a push, an immediate engagement, and a contact that had been planned for, and hasty would be response to things unfolding in a Murphy-like way, and then calls for fire and such. Now, the one thing I don't want to do here is I don't want to indict some two very specific ways in which the U.S. Armed Forces direct fires in a fashion that I think is very effective. The first one is those legendary and badass U.S. Air Force combat controller specialists, the CCTs, with their 140 pounds of comms in a backpack in which, acting as combat controllers who are also air traffic controllers, who are lining up B-52s, F-15s, F-16s, F-18s, whatever is airborne, whatever is carrying, whatever gun truck is up there that's carrying munitions that is going to direct to a very specific part of the earth. These guys, when you think about it historically, are probably the most lethal single human beings in the warrior history of the human race because of the kind of hate that they can rain down accurately and specifically on targets that they call in. They are members of Air Force Special Tactics. There are special tactics squadrons in which you will find the pararescuemen, the PJs, the CCTs, and such. They have one of the longest training pipelines in the U.S. Armed Forces. Now, mind you, remember, I am always talking about vanilla forces here. Could there be black forces like CAG, which was formerly known as Delta, and the Army of Northern Virginia, and other of these shadowy modalities that may have training pipelines longer than this? It's possible. I don't know, so I'm not going to talk about it here. But the combat control career field, according to Air Force Special Tactics, is 97 weeks. Do the math, 97 weeks. Now, mind you, 97 weeks is a little under 2 years. It is my understanding that it's probably closer to 3 years because these combat controllers not only go through Air Force boot camp, not only do they get parachute qualified, not only do they get air controller qualified, not only do they have to have an amazing amount of physical fitness, but there is so much training that they have to, it's not only memorization, it's an understanding of what can airframes deliver and what do those bombs do, what are going to be the safety requirements for how far one has to be away if you're on the forward line of troops and you're directing this in contact, especially in a hasty fashion. So look, all hail the CCT. So I just want to call them out and say, amazing job, gentlemen. I would call out one Medal of Honor recipient who died in 2002, tragically. He was a combat controller, and he on August 22nd, 2018, he got that Medal of Honor for his actions at the Battle of Takhor Gar in Afghanistan. He's the first airman to receive the Medal of Honor since the Vietnam War. And he was just a stud. So I remember reading his book, and I was just so impressed. And, of course, when I say reading his book, a book about John A. Chapman. So I told you there's two. That's the first. The second one is, does America, and again, we're sort of teasing at the edge here. This is a vanilla podcast. I don't cover black stuff. I don't cover three-letter agencies for the most part or any of that because I don't have access to that. Nor do I have the rights to speculate on things that I don't have an evidentiary basis for. So I'm giving you that proviso. I think that we can all look at the OSINT, the open source intelligence out there that's available, and all the data that's available to us to say that, for instance, regionally in the Pacific, if there was a singletary hypersonic munition, by the way, hypersonics, oh, is that 21st century? No, it's not. IRBMs, intermediate range ballistic missiles, and ICBMs, intercontinental range ballistic missiles. They've been with us since the 1950s, and they've been traveling at hypersonic speeds since the 1950s. It is taking hypersonics and putting it in smaller packages that is a new deal now that, by the way, the West has failed at catastrophically and in detail. They have already canceled two programs in the U.S. to try to develop hypervelocity missiles that have failed in detail. By the way, for those of you who don't know, about 3, 4, maybe 5 times a week, depending on how not lazy I am that particular week, as the Smedley D. Butler Fellow at the Libertarian Institute, they have a blog. And on that blog, I show you all the gory and just, one can say, sickening details of malpractice and military fraud and all of the nonsense that goes on with all the services and the Pentagon, not only in acquisitions, but in developing these exquisite platform systems. Exquisite platforms, again, extraordinarily expensive. Everybody here knows who is listening to me how I feel about aircraft carriers. They are the chariot and crossbow of the 21st century, and the sooner we retire them and give fish a home, the better. But nonetheless, if you go there on practically a daily basis, I do a shallow dive into the various embarrassments and malpractice that we see in the U.S. DOD and among what the NATO midgets are up to also. That's most of that concentration. So if you want to laugh or you want to cry, I urge you to go to the Libertarian Institute. And I am the fellow there. Go to the blog and you'll see some of my postings. Well, apart from that, what we have, so until someone proves otherwise to me, I think that not only do we have a non-air breathing, which means a space capability, and again, this goes into secret squirrel stuff that I don't have to cover here, but we're going to make certain assumptions that once an IRBM or ICBM, let's say maybe a suspicious place like the Korean Peninsula, maybe the northern part of the Korean Peninsula, launches a singleton or launches two or three of these in a rather, it could be fast, but nonetheless, it would be a rather long trajectory, I suspect that we may, and I'm saying I suspect, we may have the means to service that target if it doesn't maneuver in the terminal phase of servicing its target, because if it maneuvers, and it maneuvers at hypervelocity speeds, we have nothing in the U.S. or NATO inventory that can take that out of the air before it lands in their lap. So in those two cases, I'm saying the U.S. has the capability. But I would also urge you to keep this in mind. Right now, the A2AD, which is anti-air area denial, the A2AD operations on the Chinese coastline from north to south, is not only contiguously protected, but deeply protected with redundant systems in order to target incoming that they have there. If we took every THAAD, every Patriot, every HIMARS, every modality that we have in the current U.S. armed forces across the board, to include ships at sea, if we took all of those and all of a sudden we had this alert, this flash message that went out that said, the U.S. West Coast is in danger. We need to protect the entirety of the West Coast. If you took all of those systems I just described and you put them in place in both depth and width to protect from the Canadian border in the north to the Mexican border in the south, you would be lucky to protect half of San Diego County from that. Because remember, the Department of Defense isn't about the second D, it's about the second O. It's the Department of Offense, because the Department of Defense doesn't spend a lot of time, investment, or monies, despite the lip service it gives, to actually protecting the homeland and, of course, the Hawaiian Islands and, of course, the entirety of Alaska. I would need hours on a podcast to tell you in detail all of the, again, I'm going to use that term arthritic. Again, I'm going to use that term Sovietized. All of the simply terrible ways in which systems philosophically haven't been synchronized. Not only do we not have the material systems themselves, we don't even have the proper marriage of these systems. Now, in World War II, when it came to artillery usage, second to the Russians, the U.S. had really broken the code on the use of artillery. We saw that in the Korean War. We saw it to a lesser extent in the Vietnam War. And then all of a sudden, we saw that that became not only something that wasn't practiced and enhanced, but something that was sort of ignored, because the indications in the 80s and 90s and early 21st century was that America and the West would be a global hegemon, in that anybody who tried to be a regional hegemon like Russia and China would always be technological backwaters and incapable of not only defending themselves, but projecting power contiguously from their respective countries. Now, I am going to give you this proviso. I hear all these people talking about the threat that China is. Now, is China a threat in soft power? I do think so. Are they a threat in hard power, as far as military power? I would urge all of my listeners, and please correct me if you can say that what I'm saying is untrue, there is no successful, non-contiguous military invasion or operation by the Chinese in the entire history of that country. So, put that in your pipe and smoke it. But nonetheless, both of those countries, not only with the A2AD that you see with China, and I think that we've seen a very sophisticated area access and aerial denial with Russia, with its contiguous border, and Belarusia and its other allies and contingents with Ukraine in the present conflict that's been going on. Because what they've done is they have this huge advantage. Russia is a regional hegemon. It doesn't have to put its finger in Dyke's planet-wide. It must by being original hegemon, and we could put Iran in this group too, and we can put possibly Yemen as a lower tier regional hegemon in this too, and China, of course, where if you're not maintaining a global empire, your job is a lot simpler militarily and in the execution and use of soft power and hard power. One thing I talked about recently in my blog several weeks ago was that recently the United States was kicked out of Niger. And everybody, especially the usual suspects in the U.S. media and the U.S. defense media, were all a flutter about this. When one does one's homework, and I covered this in the blog, military and hard power, the majority of the military and hard power in Africa, as we speak, is sponsored by the Russian. The majority of soft power, economic power, infrastructure power, is subsidized by the Chinese. The Chinese and the Russians and others in the BRICS coalition are quickly establishing and carving out what were formerly U.S. and Western backwaters into BRICS backwaters and kicking out the United States. So all of this brings me to this notion. So synchronization of fires, why is that so important? I hope I've emphasized to you why it's so important in an active near peer or peer conflict, why one has to synchronize one's fires in your artillery systems. Remember that I'm characterizing this in a 21st century fashion. Well, what's America been up to as far as that's concerned? Does it have mature counter-battery capabilities in a near-peer-to-peer fight? Does it have things like, let's see here, I'm looking at my notes. Let's see, JADC2, which is the Joint All-Domain Command and Control. It's a speed of kill chain that's connecting sensors to shooters. It's a mess right now. The Air Force has an advanced battle management system. Now, picture that 1953 War of the Worlds George Pal film. If you haven't seen it, it's brilliant. You had the alien martial weapon systems, the tripods. In this case, they were floating on gravitational fields. But whenever they were hit, there was a dome around them that when they were hit, it would light up the dome and they wouldn't be harmed and it would bounce off of the dome because apparently they had synchronized sensors and effectors, and they would immediately service the target that had fired at them in the first place. Now, the Advanced Battle Management System, I've been involved tangentially with this thing for years now. You would think the Air Force is a sponsor of that. JADC2 is the Army. The Navy has some other programs, but there is no joint synchronization for fires. If you'll all recall in the invasion of Grenada, in 1983, there were terrible communications and synchronization issues where the Navy and the Air Force and the Army simply couldn't talk to each other. By the way, if you don't have command and control, and in this case C4I could be command, control, communications, computers, and intelligence, C4I is what, who knows what the permutation is that they're going to come up with. If the U.S. excels at anything, it's coming up with new names for systems that don't work. But nonetheless, we have the ABMS system, and it is in a terrible way. We have JADC2. It is in a terrible way. So I want to quote from some articles here that you will find fascinating. Mind you, again, all domain, multi-domain, what that means is that mud to space, some argo that we've used in the military, which means that maybe from the bottom of the sea or the mud on an island or a landmass up to space, which would be air breathing and non-air breathing. Low Earth orbit, of course, being non-air breathing where satellite comms are available and such. When you look at these, we have to coordinate all that. Can we use those mud to space sensors and shooters and let them coordinate together so that they can take whatever is closest, fastest, and mostest to whatever target it is that has to be serviced and do that in a timely fashion? Well, the answer for the West is they can't. Now, I'll tell you what, and this is from a 2022 document believe it or not. The Joint All-Domain Command and Control, JADC2, is an enormous effort in information sharing. This is a quote. Sense, make sense, and act to empower joint force commanders in warfighting. The effort will take advantage of material and non-material solutions, as well as modifying existing policies. Now, there's a number of opportunities that it talks about here that are available. But what this tells you, because this comes from the Acquisition Information Research Center, is that when you have opportunities, what that means is they want people to tell them, well, how do we shape the conditions? How do we do this? What this is prima facie evidence that JADC2 is a mess, because they're still trying to fill in the blanks, crayon in the edges, and come up with a sensible solution to this. They're not near it in any fashion whatsoever. Now, I was talking to you about ABMS. I've been acquainted with this and adjacently working on it very few times in the past 10 years. I hope you're sitting down for this. This is from a 9/1/2023 article on Defense One. And by the way, when it comes to defense intellectuals and the defense intelligentsia and keeping abreast of what's going on, make sure that you are a wide consumer of things so that you can read between the lines and see what the reality really is and the stuff that they do. Because for the most part, unfortunately, journalists today don't do a lot of investigation, and they republish press releases by government organizations. So always look at this information with a grain of salt, to include what I'm talking to you about right now. In early, now remember, this is written in September 2023. In early 2024, the services plan to launch cloud-based command and control technologies in 3 undisclosed locations. Okay. The Air Force's top tech integration office is only a year old, mind you, this is 2023, but it has big plans to bring cloud-based command and control and other digital infrastructure to operators in 2024. Brigadier General Luke Cropsey says, quote, if we don't get our budget next month, that's all going to get slow-rolled. Emphasis on slow-rolled. This thing has been slow-rolled for decades. And of course, he says, quote, we're delivering capability now. This isn't a future endeavor. This is like here and how things are hitting the street. No, it's not. The Air Force stood up C-3BM last year. And of course, you ask, well, what in the world is C-3BM? But of course, that's Command, Control, Communications, and Battle Management. And by the way, in Defense Scoop in February 2024 of this year, that same Brigadier General Luke Cropsey said, yeah, I think we're going to be pumping the brakes on expectations on this because, you know, not having a budget, it's quite frankly what's killing me, end of quote. My budget was supposed to double this year, so my ability to do what we need to do at scale is literally completely hamstrung right now. Cropsey is charged with leading modernization for the Air Force's C-3BM Enterprise, which is its contribution to the Pentagon-wide effort known as Joint All-Domain Command and Control, JADC2, that I talked about earlier. And then it goes on to say, but the service delivered the cloud-based command and control capability to U.S. Northern Command and North American Aerospace Defense Command in October 2023. I would love to see proof of that. And now they have a plan to expand that CBC2 to other air defense sectors. Now, mind you, when you read this stuff, in this case it's from Defense Scoop, and this other article that I was talking about, you see all of these budgetary problems that they have. Well, they cut our funding here, they cut our funding there. Well, of course they did. That's the nature of the beast, because they only have $1 trillion to deal with when you include the DOE efforts attached to DOD for nuclear programs. The Air Force requested, and again, this goes back to the Defense One document, the Air Force requested $500.6 million for ABMS in fiscal 2024, about twice the amount it got in 2023. That dramatic increase is larger because we're trying to start scaling actual fielding capability. By the way, you will note that in the previous Defense Scoop article, he talked about scaling as being so important, but so unattainable. Now, it's really interesting, too, because Brigadier General Daniel Clayton, Air Force's lead for the ABMS cross-functional team, he said, quote, "We did a very thorough analysis of that. And then that is what's driving the uses and the use cases of what CROPSI needs," the guy that I just talked about. And they go on in this and they see a key part of ABMS is deploying a cloud-based command and control solution called CBC2, which is sort of adjacent, if not a critical part, of apparently making this work. By the way, in a near-peer or peer fight, if you base all of your target information and intelligence and assessments and situational awareness and situational understanding on always having access not only to cloud-based information, but also on GPS and things like that, you are not planning correctly for the wars that are going to occur in the 21st century. I am going to suggest this is an existential crisis for American arms and Western arms and the NATO midgets. If they don't fix this problem with all the jingoistic war drums from the U.S. and the West, pushing an index finger in the chest of China, pushing an index finger in the chest of Iran, doing the same thing to Russia, what they're doing is they're saying, yeah, we're the big guy on the block. We're the big bullies. We've got what it takes. We can cash the checks. We can do this. If you cannot synchronize your fires with your sensors and effectors, and you're fighting against people who have broke the code on that to a much larger extent than you did, you are going to lose in a very large way, and there's going to be a lot of American and NATO men who are going to be dying as a result of this conceit. So you're going to ask yourself, well, Bill, what are you saying here? Are you saying that the West is unprepared to fight a regional hegemon like Russia, who's wearing the skin suit of the USSR and is not a shadow of their once feted and legendary Red Army and associated Warsaw Pact forces? What I'm telling you is that my assessment, especially watching the last 2 years with what the Russians have been doing in the Ukraine, and I don't pay a lot of attention to the mainstream media, which I call the coprophile media. You can look that up and you'll figure out why I call them that. I'm not getting good information there, even though I have to say that in all my years as an adult, as a professional and amateur observer of human conflict, I have never been in a situation like I am when it comes to finding the good information versus the bad information and the reliable data in a war as I've seen with the Ukraine-Russia conflict. But I still hold to the conclusion, and I held to this conclusion the first month that the special military operation launched itself from Russia into the Ukraine, that ultimately the Ukraine could never win. Ultimately, Russia could possibly win. Ultimately, Russia would get a stalemate, and that ultimately Russia would possess the eastern third of the Ukraine from now unto perpetuity. My friend and colleague Les Grau, who I hold in the highest esteem, is one of those defense intellectuals out there who not only speaks Russian, for instance, is not only historically literate, but he also comes up with conclusions that are evidence-based and philosophically and morally correct. So in 2018, he published a very interesting PDF, and in my show notes, I put access to this PDF in there, and I would urge you, if you get a chance, to read this, and it's footnoted, and he brings the receipts, and it's called "The Russian Reconnaissance Fire Complex Comes of Age." It is Lester W. Grau and Charles K. Bartels, May 2018. Remember, this is almost 4 years before the invasion by the Russians. He works at the FMSO, which is the Foreign Military Studies Office. I urge you, if you get a chance from an open source intelligence perspective, if you want to get a really good idea of what the Russian and by extension the Chinese military forces are becoming capable of doing in the future near peer and peer conflicts, it's a great place to go. and that's FMSO, and you can find this PDF there. I wanted to read his conclusion, and it's quite detailed in the treatment of, well, how did they get this right, how did they synchronize it, and what were they after? Here's what the Russians were after. Quote, the reconnaissance fire system has now been successfully deployed and battle-tested and is part of Russian field artillery capabilities. And remember, 21st century artillery modalities. Everything that leaps from the ground to intercept air targets or ground targets. In the words of Deputy Chief of Staff of Ground Forces, Major General Vadim Marusin, quote, today the cycle reconnaissance engagement takes literally 10 seconds, and we have seen that in real time in Russia, in America, and the West can't do that as we speak. In Les Grau's conclusion, he says, quote, the Russian Federation is making great efforts to develop a robust C4ISR system. Now, command, control, communications, computers, and intelligence, and then ISR, which is intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, which is a spectrum of capabilities that lend themselves to a situational understanding with sensors to lead to the targeting that he's talking about. That these quickly direct various types of fires, or more simply stated, the Russians are developing fast and reliable means to put steel, round, shells, missiles on target. Although UAVs are an important part of the capability, UAVs only complement the reconnaissance strike system, and the Russians are by no means solely reliant upon them. The Russian Federation has made great efforts to incorporate UAV capabilities, but is also incorporating other sensors, such as ground-based radar and communication systems, to build a unified reconnaissance strike system. The difficulties of fielding a unified ROS are likely more related to interfacing various technologies and ensuring rapid and reliable comms. In practice, ROS is being implemented throughout the Strelitz Reconnaissance Command and Control and Communication System. If Strelitz truly functions as described, and we've seen evidence that it truly functions in the special military operation, the Russian armed forces will need only one system to rapidly task fires at all levels of battles, from frontline artillery to deep strikes and aviation through rear area missile strikes, truly fielding a unified reconnaissance fire system. Now, please, I would urge you, I never want my listeners and my readers to my dispatchers to say, well, okay, what's your evidence? I want to provide the evidence. If my readers come up with a sensibility that shows maybe Les Grau happens to be off in that assignation, but remember, he wrote this 4 years beforehand, and it turns out that they made leaps and bounds in those 4 years to develop a system that is tremendously effective at putting steel on target, especially if those targets are mobile. Now, in that 2018 treatment, UAVs are sort of like a sideshow. What we know now, 4 years later, 4 years, by the way, that's so little time when it comes to a revolution in military affairs. We know better than that. And I treated this in the last episode where I talked about the Russian influence on the Azerbaijani yen to make one of their fulcrums, one of their primary critical paths to achieve victory over Armenia, the use of unmanned aerial systems, both for ISR, which would give you third-party targeting, and also for delivering munitions. Whether those are delivered by dropping them from those UASs or actually taking the UASs and landing inside the open hatch of a tank and exploding. So between that document in 2018, what we've seen in the special military operation, what we've seen in the rapid, for instance, Lancet generational development and evolution and what they've been able to achieve, the Russians have wrapped their heads around and broken the code for fires delivery that the U.S. Armed Forces and the NATO midgets have not. Now, mind you, in the BRICS coalition, of course, I'll bet there is a whole lot of back-channel liaison talk between the Chinese and the Russians. And when you match both of their respective and different manufacturing capabilities, there is a lot to be said for what that kind of symbiosis is creating, not only in the background, but how it's helping them evolve their TTP to ultimately destroy any hopes of the Ukraine besting Russian arms in Ukraine proper. I am going to suggest that the Russians have exponentially improved the effectiveness of their strike reconnaissance complex. I would remind you that there's nothing new here when it comes to the Russian use of massed artillery, even the new 21st century permutation that I told you about at the beginning of this podcast. There's a fires optimization order that was found in a book from 1944, translated loosely from the Russian, and it reads, fire, fire everything, and that's what we're seeing. I like to talk about the Russian advances in arms since 2004, but if we simply go back to the Battle of Grozny, the second Battle of Grozny, not the one in 1995 where the Russians got their asses handed to them by the Chechens, but the 1997 standoff, and again, the FMSO addresses this in a great publication. I'll see if I remember to put it in the show notes, in which they just stood outside of the city of Grozny, and they reduced it and leveled it because of the problems they had had in 95 with massed artillery fires. So what I'm telling you is that not only is there a certain operational genius as a regional hegemon that the Russians have been able to take advantage of with the Russian Army 2.0 that we've seen emerging in the 21st century, but they have a rich and scalable heritage in knowing how artillery works that they're using to their advantage as we speak, and the U.S. and the West is not. So I'm really good at identifying problems, but according to some listeners, I'm not so good at assigning possible solutions. Well, let's do this. What is a successful strike fires complex? I'm going to give you sort of like some bullet points I came up with. It is seamless synchronization at the tactical and operational and strategic levels to achieve censored effector optimization. To me, that comes from the University of the Intuitively Obvious. Near real-time or real-time kinetic effects on target could be non-kinetic in the future. But the problem with non-kinetic, in this case, would be, let's say, microwave servicing of airborne targets or laser servicing of airborne targets. There is no technical solution yet to the fratricide that could involve, because it's pretty hard to make aircraft, which have to be light by their very nature and aren't really armored in the fashion that one would hope, that they will be subject to these non-kinetic effects in the same cone of engagement that the enemy aircraft are. Deliberate and hasty fires planning and dynamic retasking. We didn't talk about dynamic retasking. We could talk for hours about dynamic retasking, but what that means is that, so you've serviced the targets, you've increased your situational awareness with situational understanding, you know whether that target has been either neutralized or catastrophically serviced to the point of you can move on to the next one. Do we have a dynamic retasking functionality like the Russians do? I would suggest we do not. MCON is the new black for survival. That's emissions control. What we're discovering when one is paying attention as a student of war to what's happening in the Ukraine, and this happens to both Russian and Ukrainian soldiers, is that for the first time, even though I think that we saw hints of this in the fall of 2020 between Azerbaijan and Armenia in Nagorno-Karabakh, and I talked about that in the last episode, we are seeing singleton soldiers, if not maybe very small groups of soldiers, a fire team or a squad, being targeted and eliminated by drone-borne munitions, whether they're dropping munitions or acting as part of a kamikaze kind of way to do it. We've got to refine the service's targeting parameters, and you've got to accept autonomous decisions on declarations of targetable assets. Because here's what we know. We know that when it comes to hypervelocity munitions, they're here to stay. That technology will increase throughout the 21st century. And if you have hypervelocity munitions, which means they're traveling in excess of Mach 5, and they can maneuver on terminal parabola, you've got a real problem for human in the loop assessing whether they can hit that target or not. So autonomous targeting is something that has to be addressed. Again, I know I say this all the time, and I apologize to my listeners for this, but I have to do an entire episode on this. My beloved light infantry profession, when I had my rawhide-bound 7-8 infantry platoon and squad when I was in the illustrious 101st Airborne Division, 3rd of the 502nd, well, those days I did not realize that we would eclipse the light infantryman as an individual fighter, as a fire team, a squad, a platoon. They have to completely revamp what a light infantryman does on the battlefield now for essentially the first time in human history because of autonomous targeting and drones and what's going to happen. And here's the worst part about all of this. The West makes this noise about scalable. But here's what we have. There's a certain democratization effect of this technology, which means that in third world countries, in developing countries, let's say what's happening in Yemen is a very interesting demonstration project. What's happened with Hamas and what will happen with Hezbollah is they have the capability, in salvo competition again, to use these drone technologies not only to take out very expensive, exquisite platforms like maybe ships, helicopters, aircraft that may be in a logistical revetment, or tanks or infantry fighting vehicles, but individual infantrymen. This has never been faced before by the neo-colonial notions of counterinsurgency warfare. Imagine if we were to spin the clock back to 2001, and all of a sudden, in fighting the Taliban and all the other various bands, BANDS, that were fighting for their own control of what they owned as country in the country that doesn't exist, which is Afghanistan outside of Kabul. That's not a country. People think it is, but it's not. It's owned by many clans and bloodlines and tribes who may not like each other, may have opportunities to cooperate for whatever is the advantage at the time, but could turn on each other at any time. What if they had these capabilities? What if they were able to use drones to take out? And of course, everybody knows in Iraq, for instance, that in 2007, all the Bradley infantry fighting vehicles, a big piece of shit that was developed in 1984, but nonetheless, all of them had to be withdrawn from theater because I think nearly 700 of them had been destroyed or rendered mission incapable by IEDs, fire, RPGs, maybe mechanical malfunction, you name it. They all had to be withdrawn from the theater. So the infantry, is the light infantryman, the 11 Bravo in the U.S. Army, or the 0311 light infantrymen in the Marine Corps, are they on the possible extinction list as an endangered species? Who knows? We'll see. I'm going to research that and see what answers I come up with. And unmanned military vehicles are the future, whether the West takes that into account or not. You want tanks? They better be unmanned. You want fighter aircraft? They better be unmanned. Do you want to take the A-10, which I'm a big fan of, but I think the 21st century is its tombstone? You want to take the Su-25 Frogfoot? The Frogfoot is the Russian A-10 variant, slightly different design, but does the same thing. You want to use those in a near-peer conflict? It ain't happening. It simply won't be possible to have those as survivable assets on future battlefields. And the West has to embrace robotics for everything, whether it likes it or not, and counter-battery fires and employment will be optimized for the winning military force. I repeat again, winning military force in this case is going to be the least incompetent force in the field because Murphy is on your shoulder at all times and Clausewitzian fog and friction are your ever-present battle buddy. So, the West moving forward, I will say again, I'm the Smedley D. Butler Fellow for Military Affairs at the Libertarian Institute, and I have an almost instinctive knee-jerk reaction to anybody who says we have to go to war, that to me the very best way to avoid wars becoming the terrible things that they always turn into, because there's no one that's ever started a war who didn't say, we'll have this done in a week. We'll have it done in 2 weeks. It doesn't work that way. So, of course, I would say, don't get involved. As those of you who have listened to my countless counterinsurgency talks and series and folks that I've had interviews with, how does America and the West win a counterinsurgency? You never start it in the first place. But if I have to suspend my disbelief and I have to think that, yeah, I don't think that the policymakers in the West will pay attention to that and they will bumble into a war, whether we like it or not. I mean, look what's happened in the 21st century, as I delineated earlier. So what are some of the things we should do? Well, the U.S. and the Western Alliance needs to take a pause. They need to take a knee and do a wholesale examination of conflict framing. And they do need to do a realistic appraisal of capabilities. And they need to balance exquisite platforms that I talked to earlier. We have a Ford aircraft carrier that's probably rolling in at $20 billion. That's a lot of money. Even in these inflation times, that's a lot of money. Fire synchronization at the organic and inorganic level for the operational strategic framework must be the first priority once this taking a knee and reassessment takes place. I'm suggesting this happen. Do I think it will happen? I don't think so at all. No matter how exquisite your platforms, the lack of near real-time and real-time sensor and effector integration will lead to fundamental defeat, and I stand by that. And the global hegemon, the U.S., will always have the disadvantage of a fight against a regional hegemon, especially sophisticated regional hegemons like Russia or China, who are in alliances right now, such as BRICS. Mud-to-space ISR coordination and GPS-denied environments will be the margin of victory, whether we acknowledge that or not. Present Western industrial deficits make a two-front conflict impossible for the West to prosecute. We don't have the fabbers. We don't have the manufacturing. We don't have the capacity. We don't have the rare earth metals. We don't have a lot of the things we need to go to a full-scale war of choice on near-peer and peer competitors. I mentioned that MCON will take on a new importance. That would be emissions control, and that's all the way from that individual infantry soldier all the way to a destroyer or a cruiser or a carrier. Oh, wait, did I say cruiser? No, we're retiring all cruisers in the fleet effective next year. The era of manned fighting modalities is coming to a close in the combination of salvo competition and attritable munitions. Now, I'm making that declaration. I don't get invitations to the cocktail salons in D.C. I don't get invitations to the military academies. I don't get invitations to the war colleges or anything like that. I'm hoping in all of those DEI-diseased academic functions of the modern American military, some people are paying attention to this, but I wouldn't bet on it. I wouldn't bet a day's pay that they're doing it. I'll bet they have other things optimized at 100%, but it certainly isn't war fighting. The autonomous targeting framework is now driven by accelerating velocities of munitions. I wish I could come up with a law for that, because here's what's going to happen. There's two things that are going to occur as a result of that. Number one, the Chinese and the Russians, when it comes to hypervelocity munitions, and you can read my blog, where I've written about this several times, the U.S. has a distinct inability to create and scale hypervelocity munitions. It also has the problem that for inbound hypervelocity munitions, especially those that maneuver in terminus, we don't have the proper equipment to service that very target, and it ends up in our laps. And I also want to say that with drones, whether they're the two variants and permutations of drone swarms that I talked about, and the salvo competition of sending missile after missile after missile into missile sponges, praying whoever is the antagonist in this case for a leaker to get in and a leaker means that of 20 missiles, two of them get in there. To get in there and sink or destroy whatever they're aimed at, there's another more subtle but horrific outcome of all of this, and that's the fact that all of these munitions lead to war crime factories. War crime factories, of course, are the war crimes, like I talked about in a recent episode where I talked about My Lai. By the way, if you do listen to my My Lai episode, gird your loins, because I think that episode will scar you, and I apologize ahead of time. The Hague and Geneva Conventions and the cutouts and addendums that were made for those were there for a reason, so that as awful and horrific as war is, there are cutouts for civilians, surrendered personnel, injured personnel, certain buildings, whether religious, hospital, whatever the case may be, that are there to distinguish the warrior, the soldier, from the serial killer, as horrific an enterprise as it is. So the West is against the wall. They have not taken care of any of these things that I have highlighted today. So with that, I guess I'm leaving you with bad news again. Many apologies. So that concludes today's podcast. As always, I am so grateful and thankful for my listeners. I urge you all to subscribe on my Substack or subscribe via your vendor that you employ out of my RSS feed. You can reach me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. You'll also find that address in case you're driving right now and can't write it down. I wouldn't want you to write it down and get into an accident. You'll also find that email address is in my Substack. It's also in my RSS feed, which probably associates itself to the show notes for this particular episode. Well, actually, for every episode. What I love about my Substack and the reason that I created it, and there's been a lull of late, is it has a comment section. And I really enjoy having that kind of interaction with my listeners. So if you can take the time to chat in the comment section on my Substack about this episode or others that you find intriguing. And also, I would urge you, if you get the opportunity to, put 4 or 5 stars on this at whatever vendor you're on, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, that you're listening to my voice on right now, I'd be obliged if you wrote a review. So with that, again, I am so grateful and humbled by your solicitude and listenership. This is Bill, out.